Blog Talk Radio.
Well, it sounds like, once again, we're having a problem with our intro music. I'm not sure what that is all about. This is Sean Palmer for Seth and Sean Sports. Seth Kamen's on the other side, and literally on the other side today, as I am in Arizona, and Seth is in the lovely Empire State of New York. 100 degrees here today. I hope it's not as hot over there on the other side of the glass.
No, it's about 70 degrees. Not a bad day to be spending in Temple. For my annual trip to try and cleanse myself. Happy New Year to all the Jews out there. Seth and Sean, Sports Radio. I think Eli and Tom Coughlin could be cleansing them. Should be cleansing themselves a little bit after the abomination that was last night. We'll get to the U.S. Open. We'll get to college football in a while. You know, there's a lot to talk about. It's a good first week of football, but man. A high schooler would have had better IQ than what Eli and Tom Coughlin pulled last night.
Yeah, good week of football. A lot of injuries this week, which could have long-reaching ramifications on the NFL season. And you know what, Seth? Last week you predicted that Tom Coughlin would be the first coach fired. Last night was pretty bad. If you had the contract is to coach with common sense, I would sue him for breach of contract last night because I didn't watch the end of the game. I saw the replay of it. I mean, I watched the whole fourth quarter on DVR. There was a lot of common sense lacking last night. I'm not sure you pin it all on Tom Coughlin, though.
No, I don't.
I
blame most of this on Eli Manning. Eli Manning has been a professional quarterback for 12 years. Came out in the 2004 draft. He's been a starter for 11 years, maybe 10 years. He has won 2 Super Bowls. And there's a very common set. There's common sense. You're up 3, a minute and a half to go. Dallas has no timeouts. The worst thing that happens, you run the ball, you get stuffed, and then you make a decision whether you want to kick the field goal or not. And give them 45 seconds to go 99 yards. Also, remember they were running through Dallas's defense. Probably Eli Manning told Rashard Jennings not to score. Then they throw this ridiculous play action where, at worst, if you're going to do that, you take the sack. You do not stop the clock under any circumstances. I think every Giant fan, and I throw myself in there. You know, the greatest history the Giants have had, winning 4 Super Bowls, going to 5. They've had about 6 or 7 games over the years where mind-numbing stupidity has stopped them, more than probably any other team. I think back to the Giants-Eagles game where they punted to DeSean Jackson on the last play of the game. Eagles ended up winning the division. I think back to Giants-Niners playoffs in 2001, a field goal, they're up 25, they blow the lead, a field goal to win it, and they screw up the snap. Now, again, it's better to have these issues under these circumstances than to be the Cleveland Browns and just be them for the last 25 years. This was unacceptable, and any Giant fan worth his salt knew as soon as Romo got the ball with a minute and a half left that they were going to win this game. I am disgusted, I am angered, and I'm 1 week in. The only thing that makes it worse is my beloved Terps lost by 30 at home to Bowling Green. So it's been a wonderful sports weekend.
Yeah, there's a lot that makes it worse. Number one is it was against Dallas, right? It was an interdivision game, which certainly doesn't help. I mean, you signed this. I will say he was a knucklehead last night to another 4 years at $21.5 million a year. Making him one of the 3 highest paid quarterbacks, depending on guaranteed money and such, in the NFL. And no Victor Cruz. JPP, they're talking about he may not make it, but nobody knows this for sure. No Jonathan Beeson. Your secondary looked atrocious, especially the safeties, which I don't know. I think you and I could play safety right now for that team. I know a couple of years ago you guys started out, I believe it was 0-6 or 0-7, and I haven't looked at the Giants' schedule, but if they keep playing defense the way that they played last night, it's not going to get much better. And I'm not pressing the panic button here, or I'm not attempting to press the panic button here, but their defense, especially over the middle, where Jason Witten basically built a teepee out there and smoked up some had a fire. He may have cooked some dinner. I mean, that's how long he was standing over the middle. There's got to be some coverage problems going on in that Giants secondary.
Well, wait a minute. Okay, let's be a little bit fair. Number one, they also had two defensive touchdowns. Or they had one defensive touchdown, I think, and one play to the one-yard line.
Okay.
And through the first three quarters, they let up, 13 points to a very, very good Dallas offense. So
without Dez Bryant.
Yes, but still a pretty solid offense. Number two, the Giants lost six of their top nine secondary guys in the preseason. This is why, despite the fact I think this offense will be very, very good. They weren't great last night, but will be very, very good when Victor Cruz comes back, if he can come back healthy. I couldn't take them higher than 7-9 because the defense, I know is atrocious. And I don't blame them. They were terrible the last two drives. But you hold Dallas in Dallas on national television 13 points in the first 3.5 quarters. I don't want to beat on them too much. They were awful the last 5 minutes of the game. There's no question about that. But putting up 13 points to the Cowboys in Dallas for 3.5 quarters is not a bad performance, considering they pretty much scored 14 themselves.
Well, I'd agree with that. But, Seth, even on the interception, even on the defensive score, right, they were giving up yards. It was a bend-but-no-break defense.
But that's always been Spagnuolo's way. He's always been that way.
Look, I understand, but that defense looked like, even without a Dez Bryant, who is the top playmaker, and you have to give a little bit of slack to the – you have to say that was a little less impressive because, look, Dallas was looking for an identity without Dez Bryant, right? I mean, you go in with a certain game plan, and I'll cut some slack to all the offenses that lost major pieces in their first drive or first half, Washington included, in the fact that you have to then game plan a little differently, and Dallas is certainly game planned with Dez Bryant. And for the next 5 weeks, at least 5 weeks, maybe even longer, because that injury was the same one that Kevin Durant had last year, which kept him out most of the season. So the NFC is kind of beaten up with Cruz out, eight or nine secondary guys out. Dallas has Dez Bryant out, and Washington loses to Deshaun Jackson. And we'll see if somebody goes through the knees of Sam Bradford tonight.
Well, he's coming off the field right now as Cody Parkey's about to kick a field goal. If anyone wants to call in, it's going to be mostly a football night, 760-283-0846. Some reason for optimism in a relatively non-eventful. Oh, by the way, the Giants schedule next 3 weeks, home against Atlanta, home against Washington, at Buffalo, home against San Francisco.
Okay.
So not exactly a murderer's row to start their season.
If you look at Buffalo yesterday, they certainly looked murderous. I mean, let's talk about them for a little bit. Defense was awesome. Defense was flat-out awesome in Buffalo yesterday, holding Andrew Luck well below his normal standards. Offense was on target. Your boy, LeSean McCoy, and I call him your boy, LeSean McCoy, because he dropped into your lap in your fantasy league. But you had to take him, and he played very well. They looked like, again, this is week one, so can I say they look like a playoff team? Yeah, they did. Yesterday, they looked like a playoff team. Did I pick them as a playoff team? No. So, look, the Jets looked like a playoff team yesterday, and they're probably not going to be one either. But they looked good. I mean, they looked really good yesterday. They did everything that a record defense needs to do.
yeah, Tyrod Taylor looked solid in his first professional start. And it's very interesting. I've been reading more and more grumblings about Chuck Pagano, which is interesting in Indy, a guy who won the Coach of the Year 2 years ago, recovered from, was it leukemia? And here is the point, and it's very interesting because it's something I argued many, many years ago with Ryan Billick, that Pagano was brought in as a defensive coach, and their defense isn't very good and has not been very good. They have made the playoffs, and they have built a lot based on their offense. Andrew Luck, formerly Reggie Wayne, T.Y. Hilton, who's now injured. And, you know, Jim Irsay, apparently is not thrilled that they've not been able to make their defense particularly competent. And, they're going to probably cruise to the division because they're going to just cruise to the division. But unless there's some real, step up in on their defensive end, very interesting to see what happens with Pagano after the season. As for the Jets, yes, you beat Cleveland at home. It's a nice win. Not really sure what else. I did want to ask. I didn't see because I was just didn't see. Any news on Cromartie's injury?
Yeah, the latest on Cromartie's injury, from what I have read, he does not have anything torn. Positive. Major positive. They do say he has a sprained knee. Sprained knee normally 4 to 6 weeks, maybe less. Here's hoping. You know what? It's not torn. I'm a happy guy, considering there were a lot of injuries, including one in the AFC North, that may very well it does impact that race. Terrell Suggs out the entire year with a torn Achilles.
Oh, it's the second year out of, what, four that this has happened to T. Sizzle in Baltimore.
Yeah, you have to wonder whether this is the beginning of the end for Terrell Suggs. I believe he has a $9 million cap figure next year. He's coming off his second, second Achilles injury in 4 years. And will he be able to come back to where he was before? And is he worth the $9 million cap number? I don't know. Joe Flacco looked awful yesterday, but so did the whole Baltimore offense. And Peyton Manning did not look good either. And you have to ask, yourself, can Denver win without Peyton Manning winning games for them? Because if he plays like he did yesterday, he's a game manager now. He's not a guy that – he's not Andrew Luck. He's more Trent Dilfer to me.
I'm not ready to put him in that category after one game.
I didn't say he was Trent Dilfer. He doesn't have the arm strength anymore. He was throwing funnels all day, flubbers all day, flubbers, whatever. Throwing lots of wounded ducks. So the question is, can he keep that up, or will he gain strength back? And look, he is, I believe he's 38 or 39 years old. And I will say it as we, because I am 39 and so are you, we are not young anymore. We are not gaining strength. If anything, we are losing it.
No, we are gaining fat, or I am. You work out about 11 times a week, so you're still doing okay. Like you said, 39. Hoping he has one good year left in him, I mean, for my fantasy purposes. And also because both of us took Denver to win the Super Bowl in a year where there really is no definitive favorite. Other things of note, Seattle, Cam Chancellor still holding out. His replacement, Deion Bailey, falls with a minute to go, up 7, allowing, I forget who the receiver was. It wasn't Tavon Austin, I don't think, but allowing one of their wideouts to score to tie the game. Then they stop Marshawn Lynch, ironically, on a 4th-and-1 run and win the game in overtime. And you said, you talked about Peyton Manning, 39, on the other end of the spectrum, in the battle of the rookie quarterbacks. One of them was very, very good, and surprised it wasn't Jameis Winston. Marcus Mariota, 13 for 16, 4 touchdowns, and Tennessee cruising to a very easy win at Tampa. And Winston did not look good yesterday at all.
Who was your most surprising team yesterday? I have one, definitely.
Let me think quickly. I think Buffalo winning with that much ease was surprising. I don't think there was any real shocks to me. No, there was no real surprises to me.
Surprised me, Isaiah. It wasn't a winner or a loser, but, man, Bruce Arians, you got stoked for what he did in that fourth quarter. Now, I'm in Arizona, so I'm watching the game here. It was on local television, obviously, in this market. And so New Orleans has the ball, fourth and six at their three. Fourth and six at the four. And down five with, I think it was just under 2 minutes to go and two timeouts. So Sean Payton, instead of leaving the ball in Drew Brees' hands, he punts the ball to the Cardinals. Okay, you can make either case, right? Because if you stop them, you get the ball back in Brees' hands with about a minute left. No timeouts, but he's got to make a touchdown. So what do you think that the Cardinals should do? The Cardinals should probably run the clock out. So they run on the first play, and Chris Johnson gets a couple of yards. And the second play, they don't run. They throw a ball. And seal the win with, I think it was like a 50-yard pass. I don't know any other coach in the NFL that throws that ball. Well, okay, that throws a particular ball. We know somebody else that throws the ball. His name was Tom Coughlin. But we don't know anybody that throws that particular ball. And that was very surprising to me. The way that Arizona played yesterday, if they had their weapons, they could very conceivably make a run they'll definitely make the playoffs if they play like they did yesterday, and they could have a Super Bowl chance, especially in the NFC, where we don't see any dominant team.
We're talking very early. It's still week one. I mean, the Jets are undefeated. Yeah. What was he going to say? It's early. Atlanta's leading the division. Oh, no, actually, I guess they're not. Carolina beat Jacksonville. But, all in all, it's just nice to have pro football back. It's just a shame for the Giants. I mean, having, that kind of loss, it's just not the trend. It's not the trend you want to set going forward, especially with Coughlin going into a contract year and a lot of these guys playing for their jobs. A little bit demoralizing to start a year off of that. So a couple surprises to the most stunning upset of this year and probably the last few. Roberto Vinci, a 300-1 underdog. Knocks the Grand Slam dream from Serena Williams, beating her in three sets. I don't think I've ever seen a 300-1 underdog in a Grand Slam semifinal before. And she played brilliantly, to say the least. And, unfortunately, she would lose in an all-Italian final to Flavio Pennetta. But, I mean, I think the most disappointed people was, number one, ESPN, and number two, anyone who had purchased tickets previously for the finals, because the seats who were going for $2,000, $3,000 a seat were going for about $70, $80 after the loss. And then people were giving a lot of grief to Serena about, are you disappointed, this, that, the other thing. She's had one of the greatest years in recent memory. Ironically, though, this may drop her as the athlete of the year, because on the men's side, Novak Djokovic wins his third Grand Slam tournament, and he lost the fourth, I believe, in the finals to Stan Wawrinka, as opposed to Serena losing in the semis. So all in all, an interesting tennis weekend as well.
But yeah, I mean, look, anytime you're perfect and then you get knocked off the pedestal, people are going to find issue. We saw that with the Patriots, who went 16-0, then went 18-0, and lost to the Giants, right? It doesn't take away from the fact that they went 18-0. They are still one of the best teams in NFL history that year. You can lose in the finals and still be one of the best teams in history in any sport, in my opinion, because a season is not defined by one game. I know look, you want to be a champion, right? But at the end of the day, Serena has a lot more on her resume than one loss, especially this year. I'm not a tennis guy. I don't proclaim to be a tennis guy. But I'll tell you, I was watching that when she lost, and she just looked like she was out of gas. And that's okay. I mean, to me, that's quite all right. She lost the match, and that's that. We move on. And she still has one of the best seasons of any tennis, I guess years. It's not really a season. Any years of women's tennis in history. No question about it. Is it the biggest upset in history in any sport? Our buddy Navratilova asked that question. What are your thoughts on that? I had a couple of things that came up in my head, but what are your thoughts on the biggest upset in sports history being Serena at a 300-1 favorite? But let's put this in perspective. You wouldn't know, Seth, you wouldn't have known that she was a 300-1 favorite unless she lost. Right? So there might be 300-1 favorites that won. So by you saying you haven't never seen a 300-1 favorite, I don't think that's true. I just think it hasn't been realized.
Right. Well, it's never really been broached. No, I think really it's almost silly. You know, I think absolutely. Upset of the year, absolutely. But you know, this woman, you know, then she was, you know, a top 30, top 40 pro. It's not number 650, you know, when beating number one. It's number 50 beating number one or number 40 beating number one. It's not quite the same. And I think because of all the hyperbole that has kind of come around based upon this and all the media, and I kind of want to talk about media a little bit later in the show. Because there's just, you know, there's been something that's been it's kind of annoying at me in general. But it's not. You know, Appalachian State going to Michigan, when Michigan, I think, was number two in the country in winning. Stanford, a 37-point underdog against USC in winning. There are a bunch of them. You know, is it a huge, you know, Buster Douglas beating Mike Tyson? Yeah, he's 40-1, 50-1, whatever. I think Douglas was 40-1. But I guess I don't, you know, it's a huge upset. Nobody's taking away, but I think the magnitude of it has been, I don't want to say extrapolated, may not be the right word, but because of the Grand Slam, you know, we've seen, you know, Rafi Nadal ranked number one, losing the second round to Wimbledon. You know, these things happen. This is by not even close in my mind, to the biggest upset of all time or the biggest upset of the century. I'm sure we can come up with a lot more. It just happens to be that this was, as you said, she and look, outside of playing Madison Keys, she has not looked great in this tournament. All these matches, players that she was better than significantly, a lot of these won three sets. She looked drained. Again, I didn't see, unfortunately, I wasn't unable to watch the entire match. But, you know, she has been drained, it seemed, a lot of this tournament. And while it's a disappointment she was unable to fulfill a pretty amazing destiny, number one, I'm not really sure how impressive a Grand Slam versus a Calendar Slam versus, you know, whatever you want to call it. You know, four titles in a row, no matter what, is incredibly impressive. And it's not that she won the U.S. Open last year, but, you know, she's won 20 Grand Slams. I don't think this should have any negative connotation to it. You know,
I completely agree. Look, every player has a bad day, right? Even Michael Jordan, okay, notwithstanding, every player has a bad day and every team loses. No team is ever perfect. except for the 72 Dolphins. So, and I guess the 81 Indiana team, right? 80, 88, 79?
76.
76, excuse me.
76 Indiana team.
But I think the point is the same, right? So the reason you didn't hear that Nadal lost to a 300-1 underdog, and I guarantee you he was 300-1 if anybody put him up on the – the other thing is, Seth, when you get to the lower rounds, you don't see odds, right? The only reason you saw odds on this match, and the only reason that casinos were taking this match as odds is because it was a Grand Slam semifinal. Those first and second rounds, I don't think you see on the Nevada, on the Las Vegas odds boards. Also, they would be a lot more than 300-1.
I mean
it's just getting the same before. So anyway, so Djokovic, that guy. How is this cementing his legacy? Because he beat Federer, who we all think is one of maybe the top, two or three players of all time. I know you've talked about this. Where does this put Djokovic? I mean, he is he's climbing those ranks pretty quickly.
Yeah, he's. I think this puts him at number 10. I think this gives him about 10 championships, I believe, or 10, 9 or 10, 10 Grand Slams. And once he wins the French, which he will win at some point, see, the difference is he's younger. He's 27, 28 years old. He is the definitive number one. Murray can't seem to stay up with him. Nadal's already taking a step back. Federer, as good as he's been this year, doesn't seem to be able to beat him on the grand stage, and is not going to get better. Djokovic, over the next 5 to 7 years, could very well be jumping into this, greatest of all time argument. If he's going to be at 15, 16, 17, 18 Grand Slam single titles, there's a very good possibility of this. Him, Federer, and Rod Laver are the only people in the U.S. Open, in the Open era, to reach all four Grand Slam finals. He won three of them this year. And he seems to be getting better and better. And it was interesting. I was watching part of the match with someone who is a diehard Federer fan, who just, Federer was not dominating, but Federer was controlling a lot of the points. And it's interesting because Djokovic, what he didn't understand, because he doesn't play, I guess, is Djokovic allows him to control the points because he's such an incredible counterpuncher. And this is someone who is, he gets to everything. And he is unbelievable to watch. And it's just going to get better and better for him because I don't see consistent rivals at this point for him. He was the number three guy in a three-person pool for a while with Federer and Nadal. Federer is getting old. Nadal's body is breaking down. And suddenly, he has more of a rivalry with people than Serena does. Serena has no rivalries, really, on the women's side. But this could be someone over the next 2 or 3 years wins another 5, 6, 7 titles and very legitimately could be in the running, could be in the greatest of all time running, because it seems that this is just one constant discussion. It went from, just kind of going back from Sampras to Federer to Nadal, now to Djokovic. Over the last 10 years, it has been consistently, there seems to be a constant involvement. And he's just getting better and better, so we'll see what happens.
Well, let me ask you, Seth, the constant involvement, and I was just going to bring that to your attention, that we just keep going around and around when it comes time for these guys to take form. A lot of it, to me, seems like there is no consistent rivalry with these guys. You have one dominant player. They're able to win most, if not all, of the majors because there's no rivalry to take that. The good thing about tennis, which you can't really say about post other sports, maybe swimming you could say it about if you consider swimming, if you have a rivalry in swimming. But you can have a 17-year-old that right now is in, what, junior high, that in 3 years could become a rival of Djokovic at some point, right? That's always a possibility. As an individual sport, that's much more of a possibility than, say, basketball, which we know these guys from eighth grade.
Yeah. I'm a little bit confused. Can you kind of run that one by me again quickly?
So what I'm saying is the reason we have this greatest of all time argument, and it's cyclical, it's over and over and over again, is that there is no rivalry with these guys. You don't have two guys at the same time that are – you don't have two guys with the same caliber. So if you have one guy that is a one and one guy that is a three at all time, or let's use your tennis ratings. If you have one guy that's a five, who's at a five level, and you don't have another guy that's at a five level, you only have a guy that's at a four level, you will consistently have this greatest of all time argument because the guy at the five level is so much better than everybody else.
Okay. But here's
so
the difference.
So he will win most, if not all, of the championships because of that.
I disagree with you, and here's why. When you look right now, that's what it's looking like. But think about it. Over the last 5 years, the Nadal-Federer discussion has been very much back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. It was originally Federer because Federer is 5 years older than Nadal and became a professional earlier. And the first 3 years of his reign, he won a lot. You know, he won in the Norris, and he really did. There was no rivalry. But him and Nadal was certainly a rivalry. And then him and Djokovic was a rivalry, and then Federer and then Nadal and Djokovic was a rivalry. And, Andy Murray's been in there peripherally. Stan Wawrinka seems to have stepped up, you know, this year or the last 2 years and kind of and made a run at that as well. But I think you've had rivalries in that realm. I don't think you have for Serena. And that's kind of the hard part to gauge. You know, we're talking about, you know, we'll talk, I guess, a little bit later about Floyd Mayweather retiring. And, you know, one or Roy Jones, even probably better would probably be Roy Jones. It's hard to gauge how great he really was because in his prime, he was never really threatened. And, Serena has that.
Hold on. I think that's the point. You're talking about the primes of these guys, right? So let's go through your tennis guys. Were any of these two guys at the prime of their career at the same time?
Yes.
Yes.
I would put, I would say, you know, depending on how long, touchdown Julio Jones. Depending on how, you could kind of say, because primes don't last for 1 year. They last for three or four. Probably the end of Federer's prime versus the beginning of Nadal's prime, the end of Nadal's prime versus the beginning of Djokovic's prime. I think these are reasonable.
Okay.
I think they're reasonable. So, the problem is Serena really over the last 7 to 8 years has not had real competition. Lindsay Davenport was very good. Justine Henin was very good. There have been a few others here and there. But over the last 4 or 5 years, when Serena has been motivated and healthy, and remember, she had a year where she really wasn't. Martina Hingis, I guess, although she's a little bit before Serena, although she's won 5 Grand Slam doubles tournaments this year, it's a little bit harder. She just really hasn't had the Alida Frazier, whoever you want to call it, the competitor that's really brought the best out of her.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm sorry. I lost you a little bit in the tunnel. My apologies. I am driving, so my apologies on that.
Okay. Well, I kind of finished my whole soliloquy or monologue, whichever you prefer. So.
Well, let's move on to your next monologue, which happens to deal with Floyd Mayweather, because I know you got one there.
Talk about retirement.
Good riddance. That's my feeling on Floyd Mayweather. Ironic that it came out this week that he may have taken an an illegal IV prior to the Pacquiao fight. He fights a guy that was 3-3 in his last six fights, beats him the way you would assume a guy who was 48-0 would beat him. I'm curious to see the ratings for this fight, because I have to admit, I'm assuming they were non-existent. This was not at his best, Mayweather was never particularly entertaining, and he's gotten duller as he's gotten older. He is an extraordinarily good fighter. He's an extraordinary defensive fighter. It's a very simple process. You know, he talks about being 49-0, but the reality is the greatest fighters of all time. No undefeated fighter has ever been considered anywhere close to the greatest fighter of all time. You know, Rocky Marciano is 49-0 when he retired. Rocky Marciano is not ranked among the top five heavyweights of all time, let alone the top boxers of all time. Mayweather did not beat one top five guy in his prime over his career. He had opportunities to fight these people. He didn't. And it's why when this era closes, despite the fact that he beat Manny Pacquiao, many people are going to rate Pacquiao above him as a fighter, because Manny fought better fighters in their prime. He won most. He lost a couple. But boxing, more than anything else, is getting out there and fighting the best people at their best and seeing what you can do. You know, Mayweather goes down as a good businessman, is a very good businessman, a great self-marketer, and will retire extraordinarily rich if you think he's going to retire. No one really seems to believe he's not. This is going to be his last fight. I personally hope it is. I don't find his fights interesting. Never have. And I know the Bate loves him. But, to me, it's time for the next generation of boxers to see what they can do and see if they can increase public awareness and public curiosity in the boxing world. Because to be honest, Floyd really hasn't. You know, he's made a lot of money. He has a great record. He is an all-time great fighter. But he is not the best ever. And nobody who really follows boxing believes he's the best ever. So
we'll see where it goes. With the retirement of Floyd and the retirement of Oscar De La Hoya, and granted that was a couple of years back, do you think boxing is going to lose something? I mean, at this point, it doesn't have much to lose. I mean, it's lost a lot to the MMA. It's lost a lot in general. And there's not much popularity surrounding boxing except for the hardcore boxing fighter, boxing fan at this point. But you knew Floyd Mayweather, and you knew Oscar De La Hoya, and you knew Manny Pacquiao, you knew those three guys. You knew a Klitschko because there were two of them. Not necessarily you knew which one was which. And now you lose those personalities and this boxing popularity, what little it can afford to lose.
I don't think he brought popularity. I think he just brought press. Yeah, you do. But it's not, for the last 5 years, you've heard boxing is dying. Boxing's never going to die. There's going to be a fight, I want to say November 14th, November 21st, something along those lines. Miguel Cotto, Canelo Alvarez. It's going to probably draw over 1 million pay-per-views. There will be other fighters, Andre Ward, from Oakland, California, Gennady Golovkin. There will always be fighters, and there will always be great fights. And it is a secondary sport for the most part, but it will never hit the downside that people have predicted the complete and utter pretty much demise of it, and that's probably not going to happen. Will he be missed from a straight publicity standpoint in regards to boxing? Yes. Will he be missed by most of us? Otherwise, no. You know, this is a guy who spent some time in jail for domestic abuse. He had been arrested previously for that as well. You know, this is not someone I'm going to really miss reading when I read my when I used to read my ESPN chats, but ESPN has gotten rid of the chats, which is the best thing, unfortunately, about ESPN. You know, we'll see where it goes from there.
Okay.
So, from the despair of the Giants on your Sunday to the despair of your Terrapins on your Saturday, you're in a really bummed out week for football.
It kind of sucked. I can't lie to you. There's really no other words to use. I do not expect Maryland to lose by 20 at home to a MAC team. Call me elitist. Call me what you will. This is not something that I expect. And there were some really great endings, some crazy things that happened in college football this week. The idea of this is just utter, you know, I don't know if you go to, they have an Oklahoma State transfer who I hope will start next week at QB. They were tied 27 each, and they threw three interceptions, and that was the game. But just a disgusting display. And the only thing that's keeping Randy Edsall as the coach at this point is they have a huge recruiting class coming in. And I'm sure there's a fear that a good number of them will leave if he leaves. So we'll see how that plays out.
So let's talk about some of those near misses. Auburn almost losing to an FCS school, took overtime to get there. Fourth quarter comeback. Is the SEC still where they need to be, or is this just a blip in the radar?
Nah, the SEC is still the SEC. But it was not a great week. Arkansas losing to Toledo at home, which is another MAC team. MAC apparently had a really good weekend. LSU Mississippi State played kind of a barn burner. Auburn has a new quarterback coming in. He just hasn't been very good, and you expect him to be better. And a Gus Malzahn team, you expect more from. But you know they're undefeated. It's early, and I think they play LSU next week. And LSU is probably should have been a team that I should have considered more for the playoffs. Led by Heisman candidate Leonard Fournette, they beat Mississippi State this past week. And that should be really good. But it is too early. It's kind of fun to see some of these games. Tennessee blowing a 17-point lead to Oklahoma and losing double overtime. But, it's, you know, there's a lot out there. You know, as I said, there was a lot of fun endings, a lot of fun games. BYU winning on another Hail Mary. You don't see that very twice in 2 weeks. So, you know, we got a lot to see. We'll go from there.
Yeah, at the end of the day, look, 2-0 is 2-0, and 0-2 is 0-2. And at the end of the year, nobody's going to look at Auburn's win this past week with any difference as they would look at any other win, in my opinion. I don't think they'll say, oh, they just eked out a win over an FCS team. I really don't. It's a win. If this happened week 10, that would be a different story. But week 2? Not so much. Speaking of which, the Orange are 2-0. We beat Wake Forest pretty convincingly. Little scary in the first half, but it's nice to be 2-0 every once in a while. We haven't seen that in a while. But in other news, the Syracuse University Marching Band is making plans to be in London on New Year's Day. So I have a feeling they don't have any confidence that the Orange will be playing on New Year's Day.
Only the basketball team. And, you know, yeah, Syracuse, you hopefully for you guys, you'll be back at the Pinstripe Bowl pretty soon.
Yeah, it'll be nice. It'll be nice. But, you know, the thing is, somebody asked me the other day, and Seth, I'd like you to touch upon this a little bit. Somebody asked me, how can a team be ranked at number 25, be ranked at number 17 going into the first week? I think that was Arizona or Arizona State. Lose, and then the team that was unranked become the 17th ranked team. Basically just flip-flop with them. And my response, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that college football has an echelon. They have the top 10 to 12 teams overall. Then there's a very big gap between like the next 30 to 40. Then there's a smaller gap between the next 30 to 40. And then a pretty big gap between the next 15 or 20, right? There's 110 teams in college football or something like that. Is that the way you see it too? Because I really do see
the top 15 having a pretty big talent gap than the rest of college football.
I think that's reasonable. I don't know if those were how I would do your tiers, but you know, the idea I think is pretty reasonable. It's just a question of, you know, I mean, I think you look at just three or four teams in the SEC, a couple in the Big Ten, a couple in the Big 12, you know, a couple in the Pac 10, and then there's the next tier down. I don't know if I go 15, 30, 30, 40. But I understand your point. And you know, when a team is 17 and they lose by 20 to a team that was unranked, but I think was the first team out of the rankings, you know, to kind of replace them the first week of the season is not particularly unreasonable.
No, I agree. I completely agree. But that was the point where those two teams are basically in that second tier, right? So it's easy to replace one with the other because they're in the same tier. That was my point to this person that was trying to understand. He's not a big college football guy. He doesn't really understand how the rankings work and how the playoffs work, and that's the way I was explaining it to him. And I wasn't looking for approval from you. I was more looking for comment, and if you agree with me, that's great. You follow this stuff a whole lot more than I do.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a reasonable argument to make. You know, as you said, I think it's a reasonable argument to make. And, you know, one of the teams that's probably in the top echelon has a big scare, but got very lucky in Notre Dame last week. They lose their quarterback, Zaire, for the season, breaks his ankle. Their backup comes up and throws a 50-yard touchdown pass with 7 seconds left to beat Virginia. So a pretty exciting ending to that game. You know, as I every year wait anxiously for Notre Dame to lose two games so they can be out of the playoff discussion, it just means it's going to have to be pushed back a couple of weeks.
Well, but they lost their quarterback the whole year.
Yes, and they did lose their quarterback. Zaire is out for the season, and this is not a, you know, they kind of flukily went to the national title game a couple of years ago. This is a team with a bit more talent, but I don't see them beating Georgia Tech or USC in the next couple of weeks.
Great. Well, you know, I'm going to bring this up every week until it's not fun to be a baseball fan in New York, because I believe about, I don't know, 6-7 weeks ago when I said, it's fun to be a baseball fan in New York, my ho-ho said, why? And my response is, now, it's fun to be a baseball fan in New York. Would you agree with this now?
Yeah, well, we're in September now. It's September 15th. Somehow, the New York Mets have a countdown to the champion, to winning their division. They have, I believe, the biggest lead. No, actually, Kansas City does. Biggest divisional lead. The Nationals have absolutely collapsed. And the Mets are seemingly kind of strolling towards a division title, a very unlikely division title, but a division title nonetheless. The Yankees are probably not going to win the division, but have a 3 or 4 game lead in the wild card, and are playing for that. And you know, if you know, we said, you know, in June and July, you know, talk to me in August. August, all right, talk to me in the beginning of September. Well, we're in the middle of September now. And the Mets, you know, for the first time, it seems like in eons, you know, the Mets have had the headlines, for better or for worse, with the Matt Harvey situation. And, you know, Cespedes becoming the second coming of, I don't think there's a Mets outfielder you could even mention. You know, it's been a nice run, and I'm happy for Mets fans. I really am.
He's Babe Ruth. It's okay. He's a Spanish equivalent of Babe Ruth. I said other day, I don't think any player since Gary Carter in 1986 has carried the Mets on their back the way that this guy has. Now, it's not only Cespedes. Look, the whole team has picked up their game. But you got to believe, Seth. You just got to believe. I think it's time. I've made a believer out of you. Look, I definitely did not pick the Mets to win the pennant or win the division. But I am a happy camper. I wanted
I wanted meaningful games in August. I got that. I wanted meaningful games in September. I got that. Now I'm just going to be jealous. I want some meaningful games in October. I'm at that point. It'll be fun. It'll be fun. It's a nice time of year. Every team, every sport is now playing or will be playing in the next 2 weeks. And this is the equivalent of basically when March Madness goes on. You have a ton of sports at the same time. And you can't turn – there's not a night you can't turn on the TV and watch a sporting event.
Much to my wife's dismay.
Yes, but she's acknowledged this, right? This is like the time of year which you get your own, right? I mean
– Well, the ironic part is we have a fantasy football draft, I believe, that is – on Wednesday, I think. And
no, you have the football league. I am now out.
You decided 7 leagues is enough?
I have dropped to 5 for my own sanity. And I figured a league that starts week 2 is not exactly needing my attention. So if you would like some advice, I'd be happy to co-own the team with you. But you get to run this one. But
I'm actually letting my wife draft this team.
Awesome.
So
eligible.
Yeah, she is. So she wants to. She's trying to figure out why I enjoy football so much, and why fantasy football, and why the red zone is so fun to watch. So she has decided that she is going to do research, and she is going to draft our team. And
that is awesome.
Yes.
That is,
so I am curious.
I would be happy to half fund that team. I'd be happy to pitch in here.
If you'd like to pay $12.50, I think that would be more than acceptable. I'm still waiting for my payout from the last 2 years. I think I won it 2 years ago and made the final last year or something along those lines.
Well, you got your payout. You got your payout for me. But
I'm still, considering I haven't been paid by anybody for running a radio show in the last 4 years, I'm still running at a pretty low deficit, to say the least.
I am happy to fund the Carly Fink football team. That is not a problem. Carly Fink Caymans. I am happy to fund the football. But we got about 5 minutes left, 6 minutes left. I know that, let me start off, Happy New Year to all those that are involved. It has been an absolutely fantastic trip out here in Arizona. And but something a little bit more on the serious side, I know that loyal listener and contributor Jeff Fink is having a fundraiser this weekend for the Debbie Fink Scholarship Fund up in Syracuse. Close to my heart on many levels. Jeff's good friend of the program, and Syracuse, you all know, I bleed orange entirely. So if you are free Saturday night, we will post the information on our website. Tickets are still available. I believe they're 25 steps, maybe 20 a pop. 20 a pop, and proceeds go to the Debbie Fink Scholarship Fund. So come out, play some trivia, meet Seth and myself if you're interested. We'll be on one team, and we'd love to see you all there. Please introduce yourself if you're coming out. But this is a worthwhile event. We don't really promote too many charities, and we don't promote too many causes on the show because we don't get involved to that degree. This one we're pretty involved in, so we'd really appreciate the support. We will be posting that either tonight or tomorrow on the show's Facebook page. And if you can donate, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah, that's better than anything I got. Jess, one of our best friends for years, flew down to Puerto Rico for the wedding. And, her sister died several months ago, tragically, of cancer. A wife, stepmother of two. And so it'll be a good time to see some people we haven't seen for a while. And it'll be a nice night. Back to the less serious side, I want to give a shout out to someone who played their first NFL game on Sunday. And it's not a guy that most people have ever heard of. I don't know if you know him, Sean. His name is Delvin Bro.
Oh, yeah. I watched the Cardinal game yesterday.
Yep. That's right, because you were in Phoenix. So here's the story. This guy's from New Orleans, and he received a scholarship to LSU in 2006 and broke his vertebrae or had fractured his vertebrae at a kickoff return. It's a high school senior year. Was unable to play for a couple years. Was never cleared to play at LSU. Played in the Gridiron Developmental Football League. Played in a Flag Football League. Played in the Arena Football League. Joined the Canadian Football League. And then this year, plays for the New Orleans, joined his hometown New Orleans Saints, and actually recovered a fumble in his first game. And, you know, we hear all these stories about, you know, people, you know, they do it for the money. They don't. You know, this is someone who obviously does this for the love of sport. And I can only imagine, when you see all these rookies come out for their first game, and as great as it is for them, for someone like this who's gone through these steps, taken such a brutal path to get to this point, I can only imagine the pride, his pride in making the team and actually participating and being a functional part of New Orleans, of the Saints. And, and New Orleans also in a 10-year, we didn't really talk too much about the 10-year post-Katrina. It just a reflection of the toughness of that city and that area as a whole.
Absolutely. Seth, we have about 2 minutes left. One game is already in progress. The Falcons are beating the Eagles 14-3 going into the second half. What is your prediction on the Niners and Minnesota tonight playing in San Francisco?
Pain. Lots of pain. Oh, that's the Rocky 3. Oh, never mind. I think a whole lot of Adrian Peterson versus Navarro Bowman. I kind of like San Francisco in this game. I took them in my pick'em league. Probably starting out next week, we'll probably start picking three. Did we pick three games this week or no?
No, we didn't. That's what you need to pick right now.
I'll go with San Francisco.
Okay, I think the line is +4. So are you taking the 4 points with them?
You might as well. I would take the money line also. I think they win the game. I wouldn't think they win the game straight.
Okay, I'm going to take Minnesota. I hope it's a lot in Navarro Bowman because that would certainly help our point situation. But the Seth and Sean Sports Radio Show should win tonight, barring an absolute monstrous game. And I mean by monstrous, I mean 50-point game by Adrian Peterson. We should take tonight's game. Thank you very much to Carson Palmer. For Seth, this is Sean Palmer, the home of 4 quarterbacks. And pay close attention to the Just Think scholarship. We'll get that posted. So Happy New Year to all, and to all a good night.
Is this Christmas?
No, but it's our Rosh
Hashanah. All right, for Sean Palmer, this is Seth Gaiman. It's the Seth and Sean Sports Radio Show. Back, you can check it out on backsportspage.com. Tunes off of Blog Talk Radio. Have a good night, everybody.
See ya.